the fact that 40% of the trips, work trips to downtown Minneapolis, are by bus. Once they get there, they can get around in other ways. So as we develop this Rochester, St. Cloud, Brainerd area, and you look at investments in transportation, look also at what are the new destination clusters, and how can local governments have some incentives to put things together that would allow options for transportation, not just car, but transit. So, just leave you with those nuggets, and backup is in the report, of course. Today we're going to move to the second major theme of this report, and that is pricing. And that was also a key session at our January 8th policy seminar. And Lee Munich and Barry Ryan are going to present today the same thing they presented on January 8th. The PowerPoint copy is in your packet. There's also an executive summary of Barry's report in your packet. And Barry's going to start this off, but let me just introduce both of them. Barry is a research fellow with the Department of Applied Economics at the university, done a lot of work on transportation finance, has some current projects working with us that are funded by the Local Road Research Board. MnDOT has asked him to do research, so he's going to present some of those findings. Then Lee Munich, who's director of the State and Local Policy Program at the Humphrey Institute, has been very active with pricing, value pricing, very active on the hot lanes. We had a lot of questions at the end of yesterday about pricing, so we said that was a segue to today, and Lee will be here as a resource for those questions. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll turn it over to Barry Ryan. We'll also pause between presentations like we did yesterday to get your comments and discussion.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, my name is Barry Ryan. I'm a research fellow in the Department of Applied Economics. I will be working with this handout that you all have, the first part of this. And we've also handed out the summary of a recent study called Paying for Minnesota Roads.
Professor, let me interrupt a minute. We're passing out a piece that some of the metropolitan counties are taking issue with part of your presentation. And I just got it, so I haven't read it yet. But you should have a copy shortly, and you might want to comment on it after you make your presentation. Maybe Lee will move on. You come back and comment on it or whatever. Okay. I don't want to sandbag you, but I didn't get it till 2 minutes ago anyway. So
let me start this PowerPoint presentation by recalling from that January 8th day-long conference with some 30 or 40 elected and appointed officials. It began with the moderator, Barb Lukerman, asking to go around the room and asking folks for a one- or two-word description of the current system. And the typical response was frustrating, underfunded, congested. When just the question, my first response was good value, that Minnesota roads are good value, and despite our frustrations with the system sometimes, I think it's important to keep that in mind. We do spend a tremendous amount of money on roads, some $3 billion a year, but in return for that, we get enormous benefits as well, more than 52 billion vehicle miles of travel, or a billion vehicle miles a week on state and local roads. If you do the math there in aggregate, that's about 6 cents per vehicle mile of travel. The state and local portion of that is about 5 cents. And that's good value in my mind. Now, it's not 5 cents for everyone, and I want to talk about some of that today. I want to leave you with two things. One is the gross numbers so that we have a baseline reference to have this policy debate over road funding. But I also want to talk a little bit about the points where there are policy choices. Road taxes, like all tax systems, can be measured against three standards. Are they fair? Are they efficient? And are they have good management characteristics? In terms of management, we want the tax system to be easily understood by both the payers, the taxpayers, and by the people who have to administer it, like yourself. We want it to be competitive regionally with surrounding states, and we want it to provide adequate revenue over time. In terms of efficiency, of course, we want to get the most bang for the buck, but in terms of a tax system, we also want to match up benefits with costs, and we want the tax system to give road users a price signal about the true cost of transportation. We also spend a lot of time debating the question of fairness, and typically this is couched in terms of income equity, but we also need to think about geographic equity, intergenerational equity, and equity among modes of transportation. And so as we go through this today, I want to make some points about those. If you ask me whether or not I thought the current system was fair and efficient and manageable, I have to say yes, implicitly it is. What this graph shows, the distributions here, reflect the decisions that have been made in terms of public policy. And therefore, it is, by definition, the most fair, efficient, and equitable policy we have to date. But of course, everyone has ideas for improvements on that. I want to start by talking about the state road system and the road taxes that support that, and then talk about the local government portion of it. The master account for statewide taxes is the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. In fiscal 2003, it was about $1.3 billion. That gets revenues from three tax sources: the motor fuels tax, the registration tax, and now the motor vehicle sales tax. One of the issues we're looking at is the adequacy of these taxes. If you look at them over the decade of the 1990s, the motor fuels tax grew by about 35% in that period. The registration tax over the decade of the 90s grew by 80% before it fell 27% with the 2001 reforms. While we weren't using the motor vehicle sales tax to pay for roads, we were keeping track of the amount collected, and that rose 128% over the decade of the 90s. As we look out over the next 25 years, those relationships will continue to hold. The vehicle sales tax will be the fastest grower. The registration tax will grow less quickly, and there are some problems in the out years with the way it's constructed in current law. And the motor fuels tax will be the slowest grower of the three. It's not important how much each one of them grows, but how much they grow in aggregate, and whether or not they'll supply sufficient funding to pay for future road needs. Our preliminary analysis shows that they'll fail to keep track with even the current level of road service, much less future road funding needs. Out of the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, revenues flow to the Trunk Highway Fund, and I want to follow that for a moment, as well as to the county, municipal, and township accounts. The Trunk Highway Fund is how we support state roads. In 2003, it had about $1.2 billion. Some of this money came from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, as well as federal highway aid and some miscellaneous revenue. That money goes into here broadly four accounts: maintenance and operation on state roads, construction spending, debt service, and public safety. In 2003, construction spending was about $585 million, or half of the money coming out of the trunk highway fund. To this point, I've talked mostly about point estimates for 2003. But in terms of tax policy, we need to remember that there's a time element to this. And this graph, which I had the help of Amy Venowitz at the Senate Transportation staff putting together, shows a 12-year period of the state construction expenditures or commitments. And I'm not going to spend much time on this other than to note some policy implications of using the trunk highway bonds as well as the federal advanced construction. On the left-hand side, in the late 90s, we can see that the construction spending was supported by trunk highway money as well as federal aid. But then we began to bring in the one-time money there for a couple of years, some trunk highway bonds, and now the advanced construction. The point I would make here for policymakers is that the story is becoming more complicated. The policies may be advantageous to us, but they're a little harder to understand and to keep track of. It also, these innovations in debt and advanced construction bring us up above the $600 million a year mark. But that may not be sustainable over the long run, that this may be one-time money. If I can turn quickly to the local government side. Local governments, counties, cities, and towns represent 91% of the centerline miles of road in the state. They're about 40% of the vehicle traffic and 60% of the total state and local road spending. And what this map here shows illustrates for me one of the more vexing policy dilemmas that you have. It shows the average daily traffic for a weighted average combination of county, city, and town roads at the county area level, and divides it into three groups: the 21 counties with the highest average daily traffic, the 21 counties with the lowest, and the 45 counties with quote-unquote average traffic. The problem here is that you need to create a local road aid system that bridges a continuum between the congestion and growth in the metropolitan area where the traffic volumes are high and the safety, sustainability, and affordability concerns in the low-volume areas outstate. And that's a very large continuum to try and bridge with your policy. The graph on the next page, I think, is where I come into conflict with my friends at MICA. And this takes a little bit of explaining. What it shows is, on a county area basis, the total cost of generating a vehicle mile of travel, both at the aggregate city level as well as the county level. And it's sort of ordered from the lowest cost to the highest cost. And there's a couple of things I'd point out about this graph. On the left-hand side, where the average cost is lower, this is typically in the metropolitan area, and represents tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars and tens of millions or hundreds of millions of vehicle miles of travel. As you move to the right side of the graph, that is more typically in the rural areas, but it also can only represent hundreds of thousands of dollars or hundreds of thousands of vehicle miles of travel. So that's an important distinction to make. I'd also add that on the very right side, you see that the costs accelerate up for a number of county areas. Even though I've averaged this over 3 years, two things may be going on here. One is that roads require a tremendous amount of capital investment that can run over a number of years. And I may just be catching a period in these cities or counties where the spending was high. The alternative explanation is that in those areas, the volume on the roads is so low that it can't drive down the average cost. On the top, you see what is for the cities, the total cost per vehicle mile of travel. And then I've subtracted out the local road aid, the municipal aid, to see what the local effort is. This is what local residents are going to have to pay through their local general fund. And as you can see from that graph, the municipal street aid doesn't, a reason for that distribution doesn't jump out at me. It reduces the cost for some communities and some counties. It doesn't for others. Where you see the line go all the way up and meet that total cost line are counties where they where there isn't a city of over 5,000, so they don't get any municipal aid in that county at all. The story is very different for county governments. The line, the two lines on the bottom, again, you can see that there's a wide cost distribution among counties in generating a vehicle mile of travel. That's the total cost, capital and current. But the impact of the SA aid is to bring down very high cost areas on the right-hand side of the graph so that most everywhere in the state, residents are paying 2, 3, or 4 cents per vehicle mile of travel in a local effort. And so it's almost horizontal statewide. That's what you'd expect to see given the distribution of aid. And it is, I would argue, what you'd want to see. As you move from the interstate highway to the street in front of your house, the benefits become closer and closer to you. But at the county area level, you're almost like a quasi-state system, and there are broad benefits beyond the county area that need to be shared. I'm sure we can discuss this graph more. Finally, my last graph brings it down from the government perspective closer to the taxpayer perspective. And in this report, we take both the government and the taxpayer perspective. And today I'm mostly talking about the government perspective. What this shows is the local road effort using the House Research Pay 2000 estimates of property taxes and the auditor's data on revenue expenditures and debt. I've tried to calculate what the road portion of the property tax is for the both urban and rural Minnesota as well as various levels of property. I've also make the point here that the local road effort is not just paid through the property tax, but another important part of the local general fund is property tax relief or state general purpose aid like LGA and HACA. And both the property tax and those state general purpose aids are fungible money. They can, either one can be used to pay for roads. And here I've taken proportional shares to help pay that road bill. So one implication of this is that the amount that taxpayers are paying through property taxes for roads is less than the value of the road service they're receiving. The other implication is that as we cut aids, general purpose aid, property tax relief, that this can have implications on local roads. The cuts imply four possible outcomes. One is that the state revenue forecast is better than expected and that the aid is restored. A second outcome is that the local governments raise new revenues through property taxes or they find money in other parts of their budget. A third outcome is that they do a better job with the money that they have. And I think that's a legitimate question to ask of all levels of government and often is precipitated by these budget crises. But I think the potential there is limited. The fourth outcome is that we cut local government services. And so the implications of those road cuts are going to show up at the homeowner as well as the business level. If I might just summarize then my main points, roads are a significant public expenditure. They represent about 10 cents of every state and local tax dollar after we net out the intergovernmental transfers. Statewide taxes like the gas tax, the vehicle registration tax, and the sales tax help pay for state roads as well as part of the local road system. State road funding is becoming more complex with debt financing and advanced construction mechanisms. That the dichotomy between the road needs of rural and urban areas are creating a funding policy challenge for policy. The county road aid helps equalize the local road tax burden when measured on a VMT basis. And that state property tax relief also helps lower the homestead local road effort. Mr. Chairman, I'll stop there and answer questions.
Are there questions? Representative Quisley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ryan, we've heard that the tax rate hasn't changed since 88, but you gave testimony that the natural amount of money coming into the system, one was a 35% increase, which was gas tax, 80% for the vehicle license tab fees and so forth. Is there any other tax structure that we have in the state that has seized that kind of increases that you know of, and why isn't that keeping up with what the road projects are in the state of Minnesota? It seems like you have a naturally built-in inflationary increases there that are quite substantial, yet it's not keeping up.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the growth, say, in the motor fuel tax, even though the rate was stable, reflects both the fuel economy of cars, the number of cars on the road, and the growth in the vehicle miles of travel. And so you're getting a natural increase in that. You have, of course, those same sorts of things in other parts of the tax system. As the economy grows, more workers, more income tax, more sales tax. The reason that it's not keeping up is that we also have, if you take a very long period of time, we also have inflation in the cost of state and local construction. And so the rate of increase in these taxes, depending on the economic scenario, you use the forecast 25 years out, isn't keeping up with that increased cost of the service itself.
They probably isn't keeping up with the wear and tear with more people using the roads either, because that's where the increase is coming from. More people using more gas. Am I correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Representative Quisley?
Well, then a follow-up. You were talking about the inflationary increase of the construction costs. What is the driving factor there? I mean, it's no different than any other industry, and it's been running probably double what other inflationary increases have been in the economy. What are the driving factors there, and why can't we control them to get a better bang for our buck with road construction? Maybe other than healthcare costs, which have been going up probably at a higher rate, why is road construction probably doubling what the normal inflationary increases are?
Professor, would we classify this as inflationary increase? I don't think so. I think we'd be classifying this as more users. That's why the extra people, the extra money has been there, the growth. More users, not inflation, because there's no inflationary factor in there, as far as I can see.
Mr. Chair, I'm talking about the expense side, which is the construction cost that
right.
They have been rising at about 8% to 9% increases, while our economy has been somewhere in the 2 to 3% range. Other than healthcare costs, which, you know, they've been all over the board, from 8 to 20%. What is the driving factor in the construction side causing the problems that we're seeing?
What I'm suggesting is that there isn't any inflationary factor in the additional monies that are coming in from the gas tax, because that's more a user affair. There's no indexing, there's no increases. It's the same rate applied against more people using, is what I'm saying. So you got.
Mr.
No,
Chairman,
you're confused, but I think he knows what my
representative
question is.
What I was referring to earlier was this forecast into the future, and we've looked at how these three taxes will keep up under some economic scenarios, and we're going to spend some more time looking at that. But under a baseline scenario, you do have inflation over the next 25 years in local road construction costs, according to Global Insights.
And what is driving that? What has gotten out of hand that we cannot control the construction costs of these road projects?
It's actually it's not entirely roads, it's state and local construction spending costs, their projection of that. It's actually lower than the projection for the consumer price index. But roads also have the same elements in them. There's a lot of labor involved. They have health care costs associated with them. It's not that much different than the other index.
I'm not sure I'm getting the answer, but I'll bet. Well, we get the Mr. Chair, Mr. Ryan, we continually hear what the construction costs are. We've had Ames Construction, we've had all other companies in here, and my concern is that the cost of building roads is skyrocketing, that we're having a hard time getting a handle on that. You can throw all the money in the world you want at it, but until you control the costs, you have also, do we need additional funding? Sure we do. But we also have to look at what the cost driving factors are and try to look at how we control them at the same time. Otherwise, I'm not sure you're going to improve the system any. And that's why I was trying to get you to comment on.
It seems to me that, I don't really want to get into this, Representative Queasley, but that's a question or an answer that comes out of the reason that people don't need to have an increase in their wages to keep abreast of the inflationary factors that are going on in our economy. When it comes to road building, the same factors going to road building are going to constructing the local Fannie Farmer store or the local supermarket. It's going up with the wage increases and the cost of materials. So why are we looking for, how are we going to control that? You're not going to shut down the national economy, because that's what's been happening in it for the last 50 years or longer.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Queasley.
Let's take a state worker who over the past year has seen probably well, you can argue it, but say he got a 0% wage increase. He is seeing his health insurance costs go up 20 to 25%. He cannot control how much money he gets in, but he can sure look at, he or she can look at how you control his costs. And if he cannot control his health care costs, he has to control something else in his budget to make him live within his means. So somewhere in this whole equation, while we continually look for additional funding, he's probably, he or she is looking for additional wages. They are also, like everybody else in this society, looking for ways to control their budget and control their costs. And while I admit that there is always a need for additional funding for roads, if we don't look at a typical budget of looking at the cost drivers, we are not helping ourselves at all either. So it's just a kind of a balancing act. We all know that we need additional funding for roads, but we also need to look at the cost drivers.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Ryan, very interesting presentation, very informative. The question I have relates to one part of your analysis, and I'm pulling this question, I want to verify this, because the memo here from the County Association, I think, is making a point that I'd like to hear your response to. It talks about how your study spreads the local effort or spending across the vehicle miles traveled from both residents and non-residents alike. So in the urban area, where a lot of folks in my area are commuting through these different urban areas to get to different job locations, and your count, if I understand it correctly, the issue with what you presented is that you're counting for those miles traveled as well by non-residents, and that would lower reflect a lower cost per mile because of the increased volume from non-residents, yet the payment for those roads is from property tax dollars, except of course for state through highways or interstate highways going through those areas. Have you looked at that? I mean, I can understand a point for there and a point against, because most of the commuters from my area are actually going on state roads, and those aren't paid for by property taxes. So I'd like to hear your comment on it. I'm not saying a good point has been raised, is what I'm saying. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'd like to hear your response.
Sure. Chairman, Representative, I hadn't heard that side of the argument. I've heard a number of arguments, including using VMT as the denominator instead of, say, population or something like that. To the extent that people are transiting through your local roads, again, this graph is the local road portion of it. And so to the extent they're coming into your community, if they're just passing through, I guess you need to recoup your cost through the aid formula. And that's what road aid is primarily about, is helping connect these benefits and the cost. And so presumably some of that would be paid. Now, if they stop at a restaurant or business or something and use services in that community, then it becomes a little more interesting as to who's ultimately paying that tax and paying for that service. What I am using as the volume of traffic is whatever passes on those roads, wherever that's from.
Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Dr. Ryan. This isn't research-based, but I know everybody I know that commutes is commuting on a state highway. So the highest volume, I believe, is on the state highways. And if I hear you correctly, what you're talking about is with regard to the local roads, any that have indication of being used for through traffic will be likely a county state aid road, and therefore should be accounted for. The concern here should be accounted for with that additional aid to compensate for that additional travel from non-residents. and not be a burden on the property tax system. Not a perfect system, but I don't think it can be a perfect system when we're thinking about having a system that's available to everybody, everywhere, at any time, all across the state. Just like when we go to South Dakota or Wisconsin or Iowa, same thing. We don't pay anything other than gas tax in those states to pass through their areas. Same kind of dynamic, which I think is a reason why we should have multiple sources of revenue. And just as a last comment, Mr. Chair and members, I think it's important to be reminded, because we've had so many years of statements being made that our roads are highly subsidized, it's important to be reminded once again by what we've just seen that our roads are paid for in a way that is entirely from users. At the state level for certain, with a huge surplus left over, and even at the local level for the most part, it's entirely paid for by users. So it is not in any way an outright cash subsidy like so many things are subsidized out of the general fund. And that is an extremely significant factor about it, reflecting that we have, I think, one of the most successful transportation systems possibly in the history of the world. And we should look at that before we abandon it.
My Aunt Matilda, who doesn't own a car and doesn't drive, pays property taxes.
Mr. Chair, 93% of citizens of this state own one or more cars. Households in this state own one or more cars. And you're right, there are a few that do not. And for that property tax revenue, even when they don't own a car, they get access to the entire system. They have police protection, they have ambulance service, they have fire protection, and it's at, with the outstate average property tax payment from a household being just over $1,000, that's a pretty good return. The metro area, it's about a $2,000 average cost, and again, about 93% of households own cars. So it's a very small percent, and you're talking about some nursing home residents and the like, and there, you know, we need to pick up that tab. So it's a very good portion, reflecting that such a small minority, I submit, it's not perfect, but it's a very, very well-established and designed system of taxing and spending.
Is there any other questions or comments for Professor Ryan? What? Oh, well, I think Bernie, Representative Leader, had his hand up first.
Oh.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Mr. Ryan, I realize there's a problem relating to spending costs as far as per capita and per vehicle miles, but as Representative Quisley pointed out, there's a real disparity is what's happening with construction costs. And I think the thing that we're overlooking is the fact that the unit cost for construction really are not going up. The price of material and stuff's not going up that much other than inflation. But what's happening, which we don't recognize, we used to build 5-ton roads, we're building 7-ton roads, we have 9-ton roads basically in the county system, don't have them. Now they're designing and building 10-ton roads, so the cost per mile is incrementally much larger than it was in the past, and we don't relate back to that. And even to relate back with the Metropolitan, you didn't respond to that, but I just happened to notice in that handout that they have, they're relating per capita cost for local effort and property tax. There's a heck of a lot of difference between service levels. If you take Marshall County up there, you got a road that's 24 feet wide. It's a gravel road. It maybe gets bladed once a week, and if it's snowplowed, it might be the third day after the snow. Whereas you take the Carver County or Scott County, they better have that road plowed the next day, and it's not going to be gravel. So those costs really are, if you're going to respond to this Metropolitan Inter-County Commission, there's a heck of a lot of things to consider other than just the numbers that you look at. And that's where my concern is. Every time we become involved, we become on vehicle miles, road miles, or per capita costs, and we have to be careful that we talk oranges with oranges. And I'm not saying any of them are wrong, but again, for comparison, we better be careful how we address those.
Representative, I agree.
Representative Hausman?
Well, I just didn't know if either of the gentlemen had a response to the point that Representative Olson made, that he was making the case for there is no subsidy of roads and, of our road and highway system, and therefore we better not muck it up. Would the Would either of the gentlemen, have a response?
My initial response is it depends on what perspective you take in terms of this subsidy. One thing I would correct them on is that while most of it is paid for by user fees, the only tax that is pay as you go is the gas tax, that the registration fees and the sales tax are fixed or hidden from the taxpayer road user's perspective, and that as you look at the portion of the local effort, say at the homeowner level, that could be paid for by property tax relief, as well as property taxes, but could be paid for from LGA or HACA, that does go to roads, that's paid for from the income and sales tax. And so you might make a subsidy argument there. But the homeowner may be also be the one paying that income or sales tax, and so it's hard to map that through.
Representative Segrin?
Mr. Chair, this is a question for Representative Leader. I wanted to ask you about your blading comment. Are you talking about gravel roads that are bladed and kind of smoothed over when they get kind of rutted? And did you say that they get that in your area they get bladed once a week? Or is that in some areas or some roads?
Representative Leader.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Segrin. Not so specifically in my area, but yes, sometimes every 2 weeks. It depends on the amount of traffic and the type of soils we have, and that's not unusual, specifically in Marshall County, Kitson County, and Pennington County or Red Lake. They don't have the funds to blade them that often, so they live with it. And a lot of this, what we call a straight county road, gets bladed every 2 weeks. And you have to recognize, too, that probably half of the roads in the county are gravel roads. They aren't hard surface. So that's why, I mean, the unit costs here really aren't probably apples with apples.
I was just, and this is maybe, that could be true about the county roads. I was telling Representative Larson next to me that my folks lived in.
You don't even have a road grader.
No, but my parents lived on a gravel road in Missouri. Now, I recognize Missouri and Minnesota are a little bit different, but they were lucky they got their road bladed, you know, like once a year. You know, but it wasn't, it was a township road, so that's different. But I was kind of surprised at the statement that they would get bladed once, you know, once a week.
Any other questions for Professor Ryan? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment for clarification on the record. When I'm talking about roads not being subsidized, what I'm referring to is defining a user revenue stream, not as a subsidy in the same way that out of the general fund is a subsidy. And Dr. Ryan, I agree with your point, and I should have emphasized this because your presentation illuminated to me the factor of local government aid at the local level. At the same time, my point of 93% plus ownership of vehicles somewhat balances that because we have so many people using it, having a little bit of general fund money going to those rural roads, income and sales tax dollars, dollar revenues going to those roads. It is a subsidy in one way, but since so many people use it, one could argue the other as well. The point being that users are paying their way in this system more than any other system we have. And I think we should hang on to that. I think your presentation is very good and very informative. Thank you.
Mr. Johns, you want to thank you, Professor Ryan. And
thank you, Mr. Barry.
And Barry will stay around to answer further questions, but we'll now move to Lee Munich, Director of State and Local Policy Program at Humphrey Institute.
I have two parts to this presentation. The first is going to focus on transit and national funding with a focus on some of the federal reauthorization and issues in other states. And then the second part will focus on the future of transportation finance, and we'll talk about hot lanes and value pricing and some of the ideas that are being pursued nationwide as well as in Minnesota. We haven't talked about transit, and I have only a couple of slides that were to talk about that, but I wanted to make sure we brought this into the mix as well. And this is sort of a picture of where we are right now in terms of the way in which Metropolitan Transit is funded in the Twin Cities area. And I'm sure that all of you are familiar with these numbers as you work through the legislative process here. But most of the revenue for the for Metro Transit currently comes from the motor vehicle sales tax, which accounts for 43% of the revenue. Another 9% comes from the federal government, and then the state general fund contributes 19%, with fares accounting for approximately 27% of the total cost of operating the transit system. Metro Transit receives the lion's share of that, 73%, although there are also 10% of the revenue goes to opt-outs. There are some contracts that Metro Transit has with private vendors to deliver bus service in the in their system, and then Metro Mobility accounts for about 10%. In Greater Minnesota, the fare, a local fare, is the same percentage as in the metro area, 27%, 11% coming from federal, a much larger share coming from the general fund, 42%, and then 20% from motor vehicle sales tax. You can see the total amount spent is about $39 million compared to the $283 million for the metro area, so it's substantially less in total dollars, although this is the allocations are somewhat the same. For federal reauthorization, in this week, the Senate is marking up its bill on for the reauthorization of what has been called T21. It's referred to as safety under the administration's proposal. And I just wanted to lay out some of the numbers here that we're facing, and then talk a little bit about how this may affect Minnesota. President's proposal is initial proposal was $247 million, and I understand that in the budget that the new budget that just came out, he's increased that to $256 million, a small increase over what was the original proposal was, of which highway spending would be $195 billion, transit would be $46 billion. Modest increase, this is over a six-year period. That's a modest increase in both highway and transit spending, probably about the dealing with some of the inflationary costs. The Senate bill, which was initially passed last fall and is currently being marked up, is $311 billion. With $255 billion for highways and $56 billion for transit. The House bill would provide the largest amount, although, again, the revenue sources haven't been designated for this, but if the current level were authorized, it would be $375 billion, which would be a 72% increase over the current level under T21. Again, this for a six-year period. This indicates how Minnesota's share would grow under the House bill and the President's bill. And in the bills, there is a section that shows how much each state would receive from these bills. And so these are based on an actual calculation within the bill and within the President's a proposal that shows how much each state would receive. The Senate bill doesn't include that kind of an allocation, but since the Senate bill is in between, you could assume that if their bill were passed, it would be somewhere between the House bill and the Senate bill. The two scenarios are quite different. If the President's bill passes, as you can see, there's there would be only a modest increase in spending in Minnesota. If the House bill passed, and there's probably, you know, the prognosis for that level is probably pretty slim, but, you know, if it did pass, there would be a fairly significant increase and would allow for a much higher level of spending over this period. So just to show you the sort of the range of how much revenue might be available. There's several issues that need to be resolved as to how the revenue would be raised. The one way which would generate the most revenue would be some sort of increase in the gas tax, although there's not a lot of enthusiasm among most of congressional members as well as the administration for doing that. Possibility of indexing in the future, possibly going back and past indexing. So there's a number of ways in which this might could happen, but the question would be, is Congress prepared to make some sort of an increase in the gas tax? The second area, there are actually the next two bullet points of possibility of right now 2.5 cents from the ethanol tax is diverted to the general fund. One proposal would be to take that back and put that into the highway trust fund, another option would be to take the 5.2 ethanol subsidy and convert it into a tax credit. This is essentially, it would be a way of shifting the revenue from the general fund to the highway trust fund, both of which are, of course, competing with the size of the deficit and other priorities, and so each one of those becomes fairly difficult. Interest on the highway trust fund currently goes into the general fund. One possibility would be to move that back into the highway trust fund, again affecting the overall federal budget. And then there are various proposals to reduce evasions of gas tax, which might generate some additional revenue. So as you can see, all of the options are really, there's not an easy option for each one of these. And if you look at this next sheet, and I'm not going to go over all these numbers here, but most of the revenue at the federal level comes from either gasoline tax, gas oil or ethanol tax, and diesel and special motor vehicles, well over 90%, and, you know, taking out credits. And so there aren't a lot of sort of, there aren't other alternative sources to dip into other than going into the overall general fund. And so, as you can see, there's a fairly difficult quickly look at what's happening in other states. Other states have made various attempts to try to generate additional revenue for roads and transit, and haven't been having much luck. Missouri had a 4 cent gas tax proposal. This is just within the last 2 years, 2002, 2003. They proposed a 4 cent gas tax increase and five-tenth sales tax, and that failed. Washington had a referendum that failed. tabs to $30, a 2003 nickel package passed by the legislature. Virginia had a half-cent and 1 cent sales tax, both failed. Alaska and Maine had debt backed by federal funding. That did pass, again, more of a debt measure, not increasing current taxes. California sales tax dedication failed. Rhode Island's 63 and a half bonds, $1 million in bonds to match federal, that bond issue passed. And then this is really not December of 2003, New Jersey. This is not really a referendum. It's a blue ribbon proposal that proposed a 12.5 cent gas tax increase to address debt service on $6 billion in bonds that are currently issued. And one of the problems they have is that within, if they don't do something within the next 2.5 years, they are going to be totally out of money for their road system. And so whether or not this will have some ability for them, because some of the areas that have relied too much on bonds are now in the situation of how do they pay that back and keep the system going. So I wanted to sort of, before talking about the future, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of these other scenarios that are going on elsewhere. We'll take questions.
Mr. Chairman, we could take questions.
Okay, Representative Hauser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that last slide, this portion is called Transit and National Funding, but on the initiatives, it appears that you've just tracked road funding revenue packages. But in fact, there have been some fairly significant successes, like Phoenix, in the last few years that passed 2-to-1 transit funding package. Can you help us?
Some of these actually did include transit, and there is a longer list that we have. It was actually from a transit group that was following a whole set of referenda. So I think you are right that there, you looked at some of the local initiatives, and these are more of the statewide initiatives that have been, some of the local initiatives may have been more successful. But there is a longer list, and I could get that information for the committee if you'd like.
It'd be interesting whether for some reason transit initiatives were more eagerly accepted at the ballot box, and why.
That's a very good point. Very good point.
Continue. I guess no other questions at the moment. Anyway, were there other questions? No?
Well, what I'd like to do is talk about some of the future funding mechanisms. And these are, I want to qualify this somewhat because we've been talking, and last year I testified before this committee on the proposal to allow conversion of HOV lanes in the Twin Cities area into high occupancy toll lanes, and the 394 project is now in progress, and if everything goes well, there will be the operation of the first hot lane in Minnesota on 394 by December of this year. I want to say that while these are future funding mechanisms, they aren't going to bring in a lot of revenue in the short term. And one of the things that we've talked about is using not only pricing as a way of generating revenue, but also as a way of allowing choices and managing congestion by varying the price of tolls on roads. And so, and what I want to do is sort of talk a little bit about this idea of hot lanes that's been tried elsewhere, and how that concept could be part of not just a financing solution, but also an alternative to congestion for users, particularly in the Twin Cities area. Well, how do high occupancy toll lanes work? Solo drivers are given the option of paying a user fee to use an uncongested high occupancy vehicle lane. Buses and carpools are still able to use the express lane for free, and variable pricing, in other words, varying the pricing using electronic tolling, allows you to keep the express lane from congesting. So in other words, if you just opened up the lane or charged just a flat toll, you could end up with congestion in some periods and underuse in other periods. This is an example of where it's currently working in San Diego. They have an HOV lane, a carpool lane, which has been dedicated and was previously underutilized. It was only two-person carpools were allowed to use it, but there was excess capacity, and the other lanes were being congested. And so they implemented a plan in 1998, which was called Fast Track, and they would, this is an example of when you enter, if you're driving in a carpool, you don't have to pay, or a bus can use this lane. But if you're driving alone, then you have the choice of paying the toll, which is charged electronically with a little transponder in your car, and that varies. This happens to be $2 to enter this segment at this particular time, but it can go as high as $4 and might go as low as 50 cents, depending on how much congestion there is, and the price varies. Can vary as much as every 6 minutes in order to keep traffic flowing in that lane. So it works like any other market mechanism.
I have a question just about those lanes that, you know, of existing carpool lanes or HOV lanes. I'm just thinking about 35W has an HOV lane, and the way it's regulated is that from maybe it's 9 to 3, it's just open to everybody to use, but before that and after 3 o'clock, it's restricted to carpool. With this kind of a thing, would that HOV lane still, like even during those times when it's not congested at all, would there be a charge or would it be free? Could you even set it up that it would be free during hours of 9 and 3, just like it is now, but during those really highly congested times, that's when, you know,
You could set it up either way. There is a good argument for doing it 24/7 and just charging a very low toll during that off-peak period. And there wouldn't be as much reason for people to use it during that off-peak period. But it could be done. There's a variety of ways in which it could be done. But what they do in San Diego, where they do this, they just charge a very low toll during the off-peak period. And even though it's not congested, some people still choose to use that lane. They prefer the security, I guess. they're not completely sure, but people are willing to be told. But it can be done either way. And these are some of the questions that are currently being asked as they're looking at the 394 project. And if it were to be done on 35W, that would be certainly one of the questions that would be looked at there. This is an example of what happens. There's a gantry overhead that shows in this case, there's a separate carpool lane where a police officer observes whether there's two people in the car or more, in which case you don't have to pay a toll. Otherwise, you're charged a toll. On the 394 project, there's some improvements in technology that they think that there isn't a place to have a separate lane, so they'll be able to do that without having a separate lane. One of the questions that comes up is, are you creating Lexus lanes which are only for the rich, or only the rich people use them? What they found is that people of all income levels use these lanes and choose to use them. In San Diego, where they have had this in effect on the I-15 for about 4 or 5 years, they're looking at an expansion of that lane. And what they've what they did a survey of users and people in the corridor, and they asked people how they felt about using, about having this option of an express, of paying a fee. Do you agree or disagree? And as you can see, all income levels had a fairly high level of support. So it's not something that, and what they found in terms of usage, that people of all income levels tend to use them. They use them some days, they don't use them other days. In fact, they found that women tend to use these more than men. The question is, will Minnesotans support these kinds of fees? A study that was done in January 2002, a survey on a variety of transportation finance issues, showed that 57% support having an option of paying a fee to use an uncongested freeway when in a hurry, as opposed to 51% who supported a gas tax increase. Since I put this presentation together, there was a more recent poll in the Star Tribune that showed that when given a choice between paying a or charging tolls or gas tax increase, that 69% preferred tolls. So it shows that there is support for tolls. Again, it depends on how it's done.
Mr. Munich, wasn't that specific to fast lanes or hot lanes, though? It didn't say general toll roads, that study.
It did say toll lanes, and it referred to the proposed. Yes, yes, you're correct. So it did say as an option. So it didn't say general tolls. You're absolutely right.
Right, and that makes a difference in when you're explaining that.
Exactly. So I think, if you ask people how they feel about tolls, it would be like asking them how they feel about taxes. You'll get a negative answer. But if they see a benefit, and this is part of the issue, yeah, they are maybe more willing to support that.
Representative Hausman has a question.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to follow along that same line. If you read this, what are we asking them? People who drive alone should be able to use the express lanes for a fee. Agree or disagree? And that doesn't say, would you use them? It says, do you think people should have that option? One of the things in the was it the Star Tribune recently when they reported on that poll, and they interviewed the one person who had said, yes, I think people should be able to. The person said, I wouldn't do it, but I mean, I think they should be able to, and maybe if they do it, then I'll have better use of these other lanes because they won't be so congested. So I do think it really matters how that polling question is asked. One of my, you know, that whole question of will everybody that I've heard present the concept says these won't just be Lexus lanes, everybody uses it. When I asked Mr. Chair the Met Council, the whole idea of it is to have people pay for these uncongested lanes. I said, if that's true, if not just wealthy people but everybody uses them, what happens if those lanes get congested? And the Met Council person said, not a problem, we'll just raise the toll. So there, I would assume, be that kind of changing target, at which point all income levels would be willing to use a lane if, in fact, we move that upward to control congestion.
And the price will vary depending on what time you use it. So it'll be a higher during the highest peak period, the price would be the highest, and it would be lower during the off-peak period. The way most people make trip decisions, I mean, it depends. The value of that trip is going to vary at various times. So if you're in a hurry, if you have to get to pick up your kid at a daycare, or you want to get to a soccer game, which, you know, we did a little survey where we asked at a conference where they asked people what they'd be willing to pay at different times, and the highest price was when, you know, going to get your kid at a soccer or go to a soccer game. People were less concerned about getting to work on time than they were, you know, for some of their you know. So again, the price that you're willing to pay will depend upon how important that trip is to you. When you have congestion, everybody, you know, adds to the trip time, and everybody doesn't have a choice. So what this does is it offers everyone a choice. And so if you just charged a flat fee for that toll lane, then you might have a situation where, you know, the highest the people would bid up to the highest price. If everyone has an opportunity to use it, you know, on a particular day, you can make that choice. And if you're not in a hurry, you take the slower lane. If you're in a hurry, you can take that one. If you make the choice to carpool or use transit, then you also benefit from that lane. And that's one of the other benefits that I think is people are beginning to realize. If you look at these as also options for providing transit service, better transit service, suddenly you have a way of having dedicated transit lanes that also benefit other users. And so that's one of the other aspects of it, is that you may be able to improve your transit system with this as well.
Representative Hornstein?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Munich. On that slide that you are currently showing, you have this juxtaposition between the gas tax and the tolls. Isn't that really an apples and oranges comparison? Because how much revenue are we really looking at in terms of the income from the express lanes?
Well, you're right. I mean, it was in a survey with other questions about how people felt about the gas tax and other sources of revenue, and it wasn't offered as a choice of one or the other. It was just one of the other questions. And so this is really sort of a reference point because, you know, when this survey was done in 2002, I think there was a perception under no circumstances would people in Minnesota support tolls. And so we said, well, there are circumstances under which they would support tolls. Again, it depends on how it's done and what the benefits might be to the system. The argument that I would make is that in the past, this issue of tolls hasn't even been on the table. No one has been, people in the MnDOT haven't even been able to consider it. Now it's one of the options that they can look at. It doesn't mean that it fits everywhere, it's going to solve all problems, but it does give you another tool that could help in dealing with both the financial issue as well as the congestion issue. I just wanted to show this slide because this is part of the proposed expansion of in San Diego, and this is San Diego. Granted, is a different place. This is through the mountains, and so there aren't that many alternatives. But one of the things that they've done, the additional revenue from the hot lanes beyond the operation of this, they use to fund transit in the corridor. And one of the things that they're doing in the expansion is providing special entry points for people to have a park and ride that's near other facilities, other regional facilities, and to be able to use transit to get onto that system. And so one of the things to think about here is not just how you finance this and how you provide options, but how you approve it. And the term that they're using in California and Texas is managed lanes. In other words, they sort of manage all parts of the system, including the transit and the single occupant users, as well as the carpools. Was done about a year ago by Robert Poole and Ken Orski that I wanted to, you know, if you think into the future, what might be possibilities, they proposed a concept called hot networks, which would take this concept of hot lanes and would tie it in with improved transit and congestion relief. They are proposing an interconnected set of limited access lanes on an urban freeway system. Buses and van pools would use at no charge. All others would pay. So they don't give a special benefit for free use by carpool. They do suggest using variable pricing, which would vary by time of day in order to keep the traffic flowing, using electronic tolling technology. It would be composed of existing carpool lanes that currently exist in the cities they looked at, as plus new links and interchange connectors. And then there would be many one lane each way with the central Jersey barrier, but some would be two lane reversible and others might be two lanes each way. So this was, they came up with sort of a plan for several different cities. Minnesota was not one of those, or the Twin Cities was not one, but it included Miami, Atlanta, Washington, D.C., and a couple of other cities. The advantage of the HOT network is that it would provide congestion insurance for all drivers when they really need it, greater person throughput than nearly all current HOV lanes, and that's because of the express bus service, which offsets the loss of free HOV2s. Paying vehicles make use of currently unused capacity, and there would be a seamless network offering more time savings than HOV fragments. It's partly self-funding. The tolls do not pay for the entire network, but that's still a major advantage because they're able to provide more service than they could with the current funding sources. And there would also be an ease of enforcement, all electronic. Either you'll have a valid transponder, an account, or not. This is one example they have in Washington, D.C. In other words, what they would do, this shows existing HOV lanes and then planned or proposed and then some missing links. And so what they would do is connect up all the roads and so that there would be this hot lane option. And also an opportunity for bus rapid transit. Of course, there is a metro within the District of Columbia, but even the metro system, from people I've talked to, is overloaded. And so this would offer some other options for bus rapid transit. The total cost of the HOT networks, again, these are the eight cities that they looked at: Miami, Atlanta, Dallas, Fort Worth, Houston, Seattle, Washington, D.C., San Francisco, and Los Angeles, would be $43 billion. Total annual revenue from tolls would be $2.94 billion. If that would allow the financing of bonds, according to their projections, of $29.4 billion. And the percent that would then be covered from toll revenues on average would be about two-thirds, 64%. But again, this would range depending on the particular city from 43% for Miami to 93% for San Francisco. So what it does is it offers a financing tool that might help pay the cost, not all of the costs, but allow you to improve your system as well as offer options and improve your transit system. I think many of you may be aware that there's a proposal that Congressman Kennedy has proposed called Fast Lanes, Freeing Alternatives for Speedy Transportation. It would allow the use of tolls on the interstate system to finance construction and subsequent improvement of designated fast lanes. The toll revenue could be used to finance debt on the fast lane construction, provide a return to investors, and pay for costs related to the improvement, operation, and maintenance of the fast lanes, including future improvements. And the tolls must be collected electronically. Tolls can be collected on new fast lane capacity. It could only be levied so long as the revenues are necessary for the construction and improvement of the eligible lanes. And there is currently, this is being considered as part of reauthorization. There are other in the federal. There are other variations on variable pricing, which are also included in reauthorization. We currently have authority for to do some of this in Minnesota as a result of being a pilot project under the federal variable pricing program. So there is consideration of some of this might be done under current legislation. And I just wanted to show this chart. This is a MnDOT chart that of possible places where fast lanes might currently be applied in the Twin Cities area. Finally, I wanted to say a little bit about thinking further into the future.
Can we take one more question?
Too fast here.
No. Representative Larson.
Thank you, Representative Earhart. Mr. Munich, can you just go back to the map for a second?
Which one?
There you go. Or no, the ones you had just passed.
Oh, this
the
okay.
Possible proposed corridors. It's hard to see. Could you kind of just tell us where you think there's a lot of corridors in there too. That's probably the long list. Where do you think that this is most likely to be utilized?
And this is a MnDOT chart of possible applications of Fastlane based on current analysis. The ones that probably have 35W would probably one that would have some possibility of fast lane or some sort of hot lane, I would think. 494, you know, I think all of these could. They may be when you could actually do it in terms of improvement projects, maybe, you know, over a period of time. But I haven't, you know, done this analysis personally, so I don't know that I could recommend. And I think it's sort of a combination of the engineering assessment as well as the financial assessment as well as the policy assessment of people in this room as to when it makes sense. I've been giving presentations on this concept, on the hot lanes, and I know that there's interest in this in different corridors, but when it might make sense or how it might make sense, I think is something that still needs to be determined.
And one follow-up, Mr. Chair and Mr. Munich. Perhaps this is information to get down the line, but I'm curious, conceptually, as folks are looking at fast lanes, what kind of amounts of roadway they're talking about? Folks are talking about in any particular project. You know, how many lane miles are we talking about in any reasonably sized project?
Well, you know, if there were, again, it depends on whether you're planning to do a reversible hot lane, in which case you could maybe perhaps do it as a two-lane project, or it could be the ideal hot lane if you had the space and you had the demand would probably be two lanes each way, but it could be done. One of the possibility that's being considered on 394, not during this first phase, would be three lanes, if you know, with a movable barrier because of reverse commute. There needs to be some other design and construction work and some work, you know, with regard to the tunnel to determine whether that can be done. But so there are various options as to how you would do it and what you would put in an individual corridor, and whether there's sufficient space or whether you would actually want to acquire additional right-of-way. But, you know, if you look at, I mean, in the Metro plan, it currently is proposal for HOV lanes, you know, throughout the Metro system. And in practice, for because of cost-benefit analysis, there's no plans to build any HOV lanes beyond those already created. So this might be a way of creating high occupancy lanes and providing bus transit options that otherwise wouldn't be done. Otherwise, you know, I don't think there's any serious effort to try to build additional carpool lanes under the existing environment.
I wonder if we could I think Representative Westerberg's question and then finish, because we only have 5 minutes, and then we'll go back to Representative Hausman for Representative Westerberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question deals with the fact here on fast lanes here. Highway 65 is one of the items or highways that's a candidate for this program. However, it's an expressway, and it doesn't appear that working with MnDOT that that's an option unless we change Highway 65 to a freeway. But I guess my question here is really, if we do have a second beltway around the cities in any shape or form, would fast lanes be a candidate for that type of construction or that type of a project?
It would depend on the demand on the amount of congestion in those corridors. I think if you're going to be if you are going to be charging tolls and you're going to vary them by time of day, it would depend upon whether there was sufficient congestion to to be able to generate the revenue. So, you know, it without knowing how that would work, if you built a beltway further out and it weren't congested, there wouldn't, you know, and you offered this option of paying a toll or not, people wouldn't pay it. So you'd charge a very low toll. So the revenue will depend upon the demand, and the idea is to offer an option. And so it has the greatest impact in the areas that are the most congested. So,
Representative Westberg?
Mr. Chair, that's my point, I guess, too, is my understanding for the fast lanes now, it has to be a voluntary toll. Is that correct? Or could you actually build a project that didn't offer a free lane?
I suppose you could under the fast lanes. You know, the hot lane, it's possible that you could offer just a toll lane that would be under that fast lane option. I suppose you could do that. I, as I've understood it, it would be, you know, a separate lane that would be offered alongside the other lanes, but you could presumably implement it in that form too.
Can you finish up before we take any more questions?
I just have one last slide, and this kind of goes probably further off into the future and really built on some of Representative Leader's early thinking about, you know, what are we going to do when the gas tax is obsolete? We were talking about hydrogen vehicles and low-emission vehicles, and at some point, if people actually use all these vehicles, what are we going to do about the gas tax? Well, there are technologies, GPS technologies, that could potentially charge users based on mileage, location, and time of day, and these may eventually replace the gas tax. The current cost of technology is too high to do this and will require a political debate and institutional changes before you could adopt this. And it'll probably require national or multi-state action. It's not likely that one state would move forward on this without cooperation of others. However, Minnesota is currently involved in a 12-state study on this issue, just looking at how this might work and what the potential might be. And so, while it's not an option today, it may be something that would be considered for the future. And I'm prepared to take questions.
Okay. Representative Hausman had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The one, I don't know if it's a question as much as an observation. Is there a risk that in this discussion that we're using the terms interchangeably and making suppositions about them? Hot lanes, fast lanes, toll roads. When in fact there are elements of each of these that have very different processes and outcomes, and do we run a risk as we're having these discussions of some muddled thinking and muddled suppositions? And then maybe I'll just ask my second one, which is more to the economist. You referenced doing cost-benefit analysis, which we haven't really done in any kind of comparative way. We now have gas tax, license tax, motor vehicle excise tax, all paid by car owners and users, and the toll roads would be paid for by car owners and users. And do we have any sort of way of measuring, based on what we know, what we as a society would be investing in our transportation system with one system over against another, and what would be the overall cost, and do we have better outcomes? If there's a greater investment in one than the other, does it lead to better outcomes? That whole, are we prepared to do a cost-benefit analysis of depending on current financing as opposed to moving to these hot lanes, fast lanes, toll roads ideas? Mm-hmm. Society invests some amount of money, and how do we measure outcome?
Make the answer shorter than the question.
Well, maybe it's if you could move to a system where all roads were charged based on their usage, and also the cost of those roads, if in other words everyone had a transponder and they all paid, and it varied based on congestion, you would have a much more efficient system than we have today. One of the reasons we have congestion is that people aren't paying the full price of that time delay that they're adding to the system. And so we see it in other systems. If we didn't have a higher price for certain times a day in restaurants, you know, everyone would, you know, so the market works in other places, but it doesn't work on roads. So if you were to go to a fully priced system, which not to say we can get there from where we are in a short period of time, you would have a more efficient system than you currently have.
I'm not sure it would be more equitable, it might bring you more efficiency in that you would be giving people feedback about the cost, and that's a track.
Representative Olson, we have a quick question. I got a Ways and Means Committee right now.
Very quick, Mr. Chair. in regards to the GPS technology, seems very advanced and sophisticated. Has there been any discussion with regard to just simply replacing the gas tax with a tax on tires? They're all rated to go a certain distance and would pretty much be definite as to consistent with each consumer.
I know.
I'm just curious if that's been
considered. You might end up having to charge a pretty high tax on tires, and there could be a black market. I don't know. I that's an interesting question. I never thought about that one.
Thank you.
I believe that the federal government has a tax on truck tires, not a very substantial one in the scheme of things, but they do think that.
It actually, for trucks, in terms of the damage it does to roads, you'd want to have more tires, so you wouldn't want to give them a disincentive to have less tires on their trucks. So you might want to, we might have to think about it in terms of how it might influence people. Cars, obviously, you have to have four tires, but for trucks, the more tires, the less damage it does to the road because it spreads the weight around.
Do you have a wind-up, Mr. Johns, or...?
Just to say that we have research on a number of topics, and we're glad to come over here and be a resource and stimulate your thinking. And we enjoyed it.
Well, I thank you very much for Mr. Munich and Professor Ryan and Mr. Johns. Thank you. We're in recess. Recess. We're adjourned.
And we don't have another meeting scheduled.
Next week. Not this week.
Very great.